This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. This is a very special trial of the week where I review a landmark article in critical care and emergency medicine history. And we are lucky to be joined with a pharmacist master of critical care medicine, the chair of the 2018 PADIS guidelines, John Devlin. And we're diving into one of his research studies, one of his research group studies, dexmedetomidine or propofol for sedation in mechanically ventilated adults with sepsis, aka the MENS 2 study, the 2021 New England Journal of Medicine research article. So John and I start off reviewing landmark sedation trials. Which outcomes were we measuring then? Guideline recommendations for sedation, and then going into the MENS 2 study itself. What did they ultimately find? What are differences in methodology from previous studies? How do we blind these agents? How do you prevent researchers from unblinding patients? How cool is it seeing your name in a New England Journal of Medicine research article, and much, much more? John is one of the absolute best minds in the world of pharmacy and critical care. So listen to him talk all about his landmark research study, MENS 2 and PADIS management in general, which starts right now.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we are in for a treat with today's special guest for our trial of the week, the MENS 2 study featuring the one, the only, John Devlin. Now, John is a professor of pharmacy at Northeastern University, the associate scientist in the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, a lecturer at Harvard Medical School. I'm adding this, mentor for so many, one of our earliest pharmacist researchers. You can find him on X at Devlin PharmD. John, welcome. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks very much, Nick, for the invitation to talk with you today.
Oh, the thanks is all on this side. Getting a chance to speak with you, all your knowledge and firsthand experience and all of this is just going to be incredible. So I'm very lucky. I appreciate you kind of accepting this invitation. And as we kind of like start, right, as you began practicing as a critical care pharmacist, what were your research and clinical interests? Has it always been kind of the PADIS world, or did it start and then transition into that?
I would say, I've always been interested in sedation. When I started in the 80s, we didn't even really know about delirium. We would hear about ICU psychosis. I certainly have been interested in sedation, patient comfort, sort of the interaction of how bedside nurses, as I started spending more time in ICU rooms and talking to nurses and seeing that interface with the ICU team and the goals of therapy, I realized really a lot of heterogeneity in how practice was occurring. When I started in the 80s, we didn't use pain scales. We didn't use sedation scales. Like RASS didn't exist. We had the Ramsey scale, but obviously that's not particularly useful bedside care. So there was just a lot of subjectiveness and intuition among nurses and with the team in terms of goals of therapy. And then I realized that maybe as a pharmacist, we started using a lot more propofol. So there were side effects. I remember lots of anecdotal stories where patients were on midazolam infusions. And we just couldn't wake them up, and realizing how important, liberation from mechanical ventilation is. And I still wasn't really thinking. It took me years to really think about sort of the post-ICU outcomes of patients. But I don't think a lot of clinicians really thought about it a lot in the ICU in the 80s and 90s, about what was the burden of critical illness and the things we did in the ICU, particularly related to PADIS or not related, or doing not some of the A to F bundle PADIS related things. But I remember, a patient coming back with their family member. This is in the 90s that I, helped care for as the pharmacist, and coming back, and we didn't think they were going to survive, but they did. But they came back, and the person was quite young, and I remember them coming in with a walker, and they had a family member with them. And so, I was just so surprised that this patient had a walker because they weren't a trauma patient or anything. And then, so I remember asking this patient, like, what was your recovery like? So then, he kind of told the story, and it was just incredible how much he had to go. He had repeat hospitalizations. He'd been in rehab for a long time. I asked him about, was he back at work? Because this was a pretty young guy. I mean, I don't remember his exact age, but I was only in my 20s. But he was, obviously 40 or 50. He wasn't an old guy, and he wasn't back at work yet. And I'm like, what do you mean you're not back at work? And he goes, I can't manage my work. He was a teacher. I can't stand up without a walker. And, all of these things, both mentally and physically. And that was the first time in my life I realized, what is the post-ICU outcome and the burden of illness to these patients long after, and realizing that we had a lot of work to do to, improve ICU and post-ICU outcomes.
Yeah, a lot of gaps because there was no real research into those long-term outcomes, right, at that time of what happened when you left the ICU. So let's kind of get into and set the scene for the MENS2 trial today. So the 2018 PADIS guidelines, which for those unfamiliar, John guideline chair, first author, but is any preference given for either of our non-benzodiazepine sedatives, right? Propofol or dexmedetomidine?
No, absolutely not. They're, each have pluses and minuses. I think it's important, the PICO questions that you develop in guidelines, and this was for mechanically ventilated non-cardiac surgery patients. It's a little bit of a generalization because there could be nuances with each patient where one drug might be better than the other. But when you're in the guideline business, you have to sort of have broad questions. And basically, we just found very little difference between these drugs. But the problem was there just was not the definitive study that had compared on a large scale the use of these agents. And I think it's important also, when you look at older studies that were completed in the 90s and even in the early 2000s, they weren't generally using the ADEF bundle. They weren't using light sedation. They weren't using the normal delirium screening, delirium reduction efforts. So all of the things that we do in practice, which are very, very important are important covariates for the outcomes you might look at in any sedation study, like duration mechanical ventilation or mortality or any of these outcomes that are sort of classic outcomes to look at in ICU sedation studies, didn't have the power to do this, or the practice was so different, it's hard to extrapolate it to current day practice. So it was a huge, we published evidence gaps in PADIS, and it was a huge evidence gap. So we just didn't really know, have a definitive answer about propofol versus dex. And so people were stuck at the bedside trying to figure out what should I use. And some of these things came down to cost. Dexmedetomidine, even back 10, 15 years ago, was a very expensive drug. So it wasn't a drug I think that people would assume that you would just use as your workhorse sedative. At the same time, there's obviously concerns. Well, is it a lighter sedative? Does it reduce respiratory drive enough? Is it going to lead to the goals of therapy we want? It certainly can cause bradycardia and hypotension. But then propofol, to the same side, we're concerned certainly about the propofol infusion syndrome, rare but critical when you see it. Still happens probably about 3 to 4% of patients. Propofol has its own issues with, it's very immunosuppressive. Obviously, it has a lipemic component, which can cause hypertriglyceridemia in rare cases, pancreatitis. So it has hemodynamic effects as well. So, there's not really one perfect sedative. But you do need to give, many patients do need sedation. But I think we're also operating, we carefully worded our PAD-IS recommendation in patients that do need continuous sedation. If clinicians feel they do need that, use either dexmedetomidine or propofol. And I think that's really critical because, we're moving to a place now where not everybody who's mechanically ventilated needs continuous sedation every day.
So another phrase from the text states that pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic considerations should be incorporated in both sedative choice and delivery methods. So thinking from a pharmacokinetic properties, adverse effect, you mentioned a few of them, but is in theory, is are any of those enough to make one agent kind of better than another?
Yeah, certainly, it's funny with propofol, people assume, I think we all know as pharmacists, once someone's getting it for a couple of days, when you shut it off, it can take sometimes hours for patients to really wake up. It's funny, I've been at the bedside so many times where nurses are like, oh, I don't want to just stop, do an SAT with the patient on propofol. They were agitated last night. I don't want them to wake up suddenly and self-activate. I'm like, I know you have a second patient. Let me hang out here. I'll call you if they get agitated. I'm watching them. This is sometimes in studies. And it can be literally hours for that patient after shutting off the propofol to really wake up. And so, first, I think dexmedetomidine, one of its inherent benefits might be the wakefulness bit. Because, I mean, what our goal is really for these patients is to, be able to wake them up, certainly to do a spontaneous breathing trial, but also mobility. Just seeing what their sedative needs are. And then I think the other thing that I'm increasingly interested in is sleep. And there's fairly good data that propofol does a horrible job in disrupting sleep, whereas dexmedetomidine I think has some good data suggesting it has pretty good effect on EEG patterns associated with better sleep. So there's some advantages I think to both.
So the Men's 2 trial, it started patient enrollment in May of 2013. So in your opinion, what are some of the most important kind of sedative trials published prior to kind of setting the stage for the Men's 2 study?
Yeah, I think I think there's two sets of studies here. There's the how do we wake patients up that are on continuous sedation? So that's important. So obviously, J.P. Kress's classic 2001 New England Journal study where they did a daily awakening or spontaneous awakening trial. That was extremely important because there was a huge amount of concern that if we stopped sedation and woke people up to put them on a spontaneous breathing trial, all these bad things would happen and that they needed sedation to manage, respiratory drive and dysynchrony and all those things. And then that these patients instantly would become really agitated and extubate and all these bad things would happen. And they didn't really find that. I mean, the most important thing I think with the with JP's study, Dr. Kress's study, is that the safety concerns were really very minimal in the daily wake-up group. So that was very, very important. And that really led to, was a foundational study for, Tim Gerard's ABC study in the 90s, where we, did awakening and paired it with spontaneous breathing trials. And that's at the foundation for this, for, the ADEF bundle. And then I was involved with a Canadian Critical Trials Group study where, we had a lot of nurses in our institution. I was at Tufts Medical Center at the time, and they did not really, and many nurses, I think, did not really like to do daily wake-ups or spontaneous breathing trials. So we came up with the hypothesis that if we had a very tight protocol where nurses were titrating the sedatives every 2 hours, morning, noon, and night, to a light sedation goal, that that would probably allow patients to be extubated, get on spontaneous sleep trials, be extubated, and have no difference in safety, and better perceptions by nurses than doing that, allowing the patient to be more deeply sedated 24/7 and each morning waking them up suddenly. So that study, the sleep study, nothing to do with sleep, was published in JAMA in 2010, and we found that there was virtually no difference between using a protocolized approach with daily awakening versus just daily awakening itself. And just anecdotally, in the patients we enrolled at Tufts Medical Center, the nurse, with the nurses, they love the protocol. They would often, be down titrating the sedatives overnight to off, and so these patients were awake in the morning, and we can get them on early morning spontaneous breathing trials. Before, we had always, like many ICUs, a problem where patients were really sedated, and it would take sometimes hours to get them on a spontaneous breathing trial, sometimes into the afternoon, and it would frustrate the attending intensivists and the other team, because they really wanted to be there for the spontaneous breathing trials to be able to make extubation decisions. So the nurses actually really like the protocolization approach, and I think that's something that, there's two ways to do it, and I think that's something if institutions, because we see all of this deep sedation at night, this diurnal sedation. There's lots of papers showing how deep patients get at night, because patients think, well, the patient, we need to have the patient sleep better. But particularly with propofol, as I kind of mentioned, that deeper sedation has no correlation to quality of sleep. All you're doing is sedating the heck out of the patient. The other critical thing is the studies looking at the ADEF bundle, which includes a lot of these things. And then thirdly, thinking about the choice of sedation. And there was lots of studies comparing dexmedetomidine to benzodiazepines, which were very, very informative, like the SEDCOM study, the MIDEX study, so both Europe and the United States. And they certainly showed substantial benefits with time to extubation with dexmedetomidine over benzodiazepine, reduced delirium. So the outcomes were much better. And I think we already knew that, benzodiazepines have just very complex, pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic factors, and that they're, in a dose-related effect relationship, are big risk factors for increasing delirium and many other things. And it's funny, everybody thinks if you give these sedatives, you're going to really reduce respiratory drive and present asynchrony, but there's a very, very poor correlation between RASS scores and what these agents are actually doing to patients' breathing patterns when they're on assisted ventilation. Amy Zervas published some great stuff. There's just lots of really good evolving papers out there. And so we really don't have a good biomarker. All we have is the RASS, and it's a very, very poor measure of what the sedatives are actually doing with the ventilator interface. So we really need better real-time markers, whether these are ventilator measures or the like, that can we can titrate sedatives to in patients that are getting ventilated, particularly patients with ARDS that have higher ventilator drives. And so that led to the question, now kind of circling back, that we knew both propofol and dex were better than benzodiazepine. There was a PRO-DEX study. So there was other studies. And then, the SPICE-3 study was a really important study that was published a couple of years before the MENS2 study, also in the New England Journal of Medicine. So this is Yash Ahabi and their group. It was a lot of Asian, Australian, New Zealand patients, and very, very large study. But surprisingly enough, they did not really find a difference in mortality, delirium, and this, I think this is 3-month mortality, delirium, or time to ventilation or extubation with propofol versus dex. There's some concerns with the study, though. They really didn't use the ADEF bundle as rigorously as one might expect. There was a tremendous amount of crossover with sedative agents. So there's a large number of patients that were randomized to dex. It was and who got propofol and benzos, and then a lot of the and it basically wasn't really as much a propofol versus dex study. It was sort of a dex versus whatever you wanted to use study. And so it didn't really fully answer the propofol dex thing. And then it had this Kind of surprising finding where, the mortality, there was a big dichotomy between patients that were over 65 and less than 65 in terms of the prophylactic use. So it left a lot of gaps. They also included a lot of patients that probably might not really need continuous sedation. So, moving forward to the MEDS 2 study, this was based on the MEDS study, which was published in JAMA in 2010, led by Pratik Pantharapani and his group at Vanderbilt, and they compared propofol versus dex. And this was a mixed population of patients, but what they found, it was primarily in sepsis patients that they found the greatest difference between propofol dex in terms of time to extubation. They didn't show a big mortality difference, but they definitely showed a reduction in coma and delirium with use of dex. So this was very, very hypothesis generating, but there was limitations with the study in terms of when it was done, lack of ADF bundle. It was just a relatively small study done at pretty much the same, I think it was done at two hospitals in the Nashville area. And so now, so they what Pratik and his team did is he went to the NIH and had got funding from the NHLB to conduct this large multi-center randomized control study. And so that's where I came in 2015, and they invited me to participate as a principal investigator at Tufts Medical Center for the study. And it's interesting, among the four sites that recruited the most patients, the other the fourth one was Houston Methodist. So there's a pharmacist there, Josh Swan, who was fourth author on the MEDS 2 study, and he enrolled a number of patients, a few less than the 50 or so we enrolled at Tufts Medical Center. So it was just a really, really good experience working in this study. And I think the key thing is it came at a perfect time for our institution, where both at our surgical and medical ICUs, we were still using a lot of cases were on continuous sedation. People were very, very interested in, is there a role for dex in these patients, realizing that it still was an expensive agent. So I would say there was probably good clinical equipoise, and people felt this was a very important question. This is 2015, 3 years before the PAD-IS guidelines, but I think this was a question a lot of people had before we, more formally realized that we didn't know the difference with in the PAD-IS guidelines. So that's kind of the nidus, and I think they found that the biggest benefit was in sepsis patients. So about a third of these patients had ARDS. So these were a pretty sick group of patients in terms of baseline SOFA and APACHE 2 score. So we were looking at a complex group of patients that required prolonged mechanical ventilation. It's a lot of effort to randomize even any single one ICU patient. So you basically want to really make sure that your science is strong and what you're doing with each patient is leading to, a really solid answer, whatever you find.
Yeah, in that same realm, help us kind of understand just the sheer amount of background and prep work that goes into this large prospective RCT like this. Because you mentioned the importance of having the right outcomes and things. How I'm guessing it's plan to make sure that this goes appropriately. So what kind of sort of things are you working on? How long is that taking in that pre-period up till, patient enrollment starts?
Yeah, I would say, Nick, it's probably a good up to 6 months. There's kind of there's three or four big things that have to happen. So, I mean, first of all, you need to have good in clinical equipoise with the intensivist. That's very, very important. So it's important to meet with, the leadership of each unit. I had very, very strong support from the MICU director, our SICU directors, and they felt this was an important question. I certainly had, some meetings with some of the other intensivists that rounded regularly in the units. I also met with nurse leadership, talking about the study, and they're very interested in terms of, well, what's going to be required? They feel, they trust me, they know me, but they also want to know, well, what are going to be the efforts above nurses, among nurses for the study over and above what their normal workload is. This is a big issue in critical care and research. And so you really have to make sure it's very well defined that your research team is doing, A, B, C, D, E, and that the bedside nurses are for the study are only doing this. And it shouldn't be a lot more than what they're already doing in their scope of work, like recording RASS scores. I mean, there's nobody else that can really titrate a sedative drug than the bedside nurse. So you can't have a research nurse in there managing the patient when it's the patient's own nurse. So everybody realizes that, but there's lots of other assessments and things to be done. You need to really user-friendly support, and you need to have really good support from your research team. Really on a 24/7 basis. So that's good. And then you need to do a tremendous amount of education to the bedside clinicians. I always use an approach, once I have good administrative support from nurse directors and physicians, then I work with the nurse manager of a unit to sort of find, maybe three or four night nurses and three or four day nurses that are fairly interested. And so they become sort of super trainers and super users for the study. And so I pull them aside, we schedule it, and we spend a good hour talking about the study and the paper, what they need to do. And then I'll sort of train other nurses on the fly in small groups, but they end up doing the training. But it's important to adapt these training, and this is what you do when you have a patient, for your own institution, and individualize it. That can take a lot of work. And I always make sure I get nurses, these super user nurses, to review kind of what we're planning to do and operationalizing. And it's amazing how they come up with these great ideas. And it's really important to listen to them and do that, because if they feel that they're just being ignored and you're kind of pushing through the study, they're you know how nurses are. They're amazing, but if they feel that it's not going to work, then it kind of leaks out with the other bedside nurses, and then suddenly you actually have a problem on your hands because there's a little bit of resistance to the study, and some of it could be completely untrue, but because you haven't even enrolled a patient yet, but you just want to make sure, and I think it's really important with nurses too, because this is a very important nurse bedside study, is to really explain to them the science of what you're trying to do and how important this question is, because nurses will really do a much more rigorous job in the things that they need to do towards the study if they feel it's really important and that you take it seriously. And so that's really important. So the whole education, and then of course you're rolling it out to the house staff. That takes regular education, because most academic centers, the fellows and residents, they switch every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks. And so you have this continuous number of people. So you have to keep doing training. So we would always send our emails with simple overview of the study to either new house staff, new fellows. We would, we obviously had time to get in front of the surgical attendings and the medical ICU attendings to talk about the study up front, and then we'd have regular updates. We did a lot of emailing updates. We'd listen to people. A lot of it is also, your relationships with people. And so I would, if there was an attending physician and we had a patient, and I'm like, how's the study going? What are your perceptions? And they'll tell you things. And sometimes they have concerns. Sometimes they'll need you if it's a big issue, but sometimes it won't really call you unless you kind of walk by and just check in with them. And usually they're like, great, no problems. But sometimes they come up with things. We had a patient, and I don't know if this happened, blah, blah, blah. So the clinicians are really, really important. The other big group that that you need to do is you need to get busy with your IRB. It's better to put everything in right and submit everything correctly and anticipate potential things that might come up, rather than wait till the IRB meeting or it's rejected, and then you're always delaying and chasing and kind of going in circles. And then the other thing is, contracts. So the contract should be cooking, and this would be between, we're doing a subcontract with Vanderbilt. Sometimes you're doing a contract with the sponsor, but all the money was going from the NIH to Vanderbilt, so we were doing a subcontract with Vanderbilt. So it's very, very important to work with your budget, your contracts people, to get all these things done. I think the other big thing is the investigational drug services. So I always meet very early with them, share the protocol, talk about the study, talk what we're trying to do, talk about the preparation, there was quite a bit of preparation. And so the dextrometetomidine and propofol were all made in a PVC bag, and then it was sent up by Investigation Drug Services, and then at the bedside it was covered by the nurse, so all the lines and everything going into the patient, and so you couldn't really tell what was being infused. It wasn't double dummy, but we covered everything, and it worked out really well. Like, almost nobody became unblinded during it, and we incentivized nurses to keep the blinding. And we just talked about the importance of the blinding a lot. But IDS was amazing. But you have to give them time to get things into Epic and to order sets. And it can take weeks. And, they're busy. They have a lot of other studies. I think the other thing that's really important for pharmacist researchers when they're assuming this role is probably to have a regulatory coordinator that's part-time. So all of my studies I've done over the last 20 years, I've used my research fellows. So Matt Dupre was doing a research fellowship and a PhD with me from 2016 to 2020. So he played a huge job in, enrollment and collection, a lot of these things. We kind of worked together as sort of co-coordinators. And he learned a lot through it. Sometimes it's more work than you want, but it is what it is. And he's a named author on the, on the New England Journal paper. But having a regulatory coordinator, because we weren't trying to get a new indication, but they had submitted an IND to the FDA. So this suddenly became more of an FDA study. And so that we could have the FDA come and, evaluate us and do a rigorous audit of all our patients. They don't really kid around. And because what we were trying to do was extend the duration of dextrometetomidine in the package label, which we did. You want everything in your study binders or regulatory binders. And I'll be honest, this is something that, I'm like, ugh. And part of it's just you're busy at the bedside and you're trying to manage all these things, but you got to keep all the paper and every consent form signed. And, it's tough. I think the other, so that's the other thing, is making sure you have the right staff and you need to realize that it's a 24/7 study. Either Matt or I would always talk to that nurse who came on at 7, working overnight for a 12-hour shift, and just make sure they were clear with the patient and had any questions. And more often than not, especially once we enrolled our 40th patient, all these nurses had seen this study. But you never know. Sometimes you get a new nurse. Sometimes there's something with the patient that when you left at 4 o'clock looked pretty good, and they're like, did you know this is happening? So it becomes a bigger issue. And so just that comfort level of support. Occasionally I'd get pages in the middle of the night, and you need to answer those. Usually it's fairly routine questions, but sometimes it's not. So what we really did not want people to be doing was ordering propofol, non-study propofol or dex in our patients. And we certainly didn't want them to be starting benzodiazepines or ketamine or, any number of things. We could use our workhorse sedative was fentanyl, and in the study it actually ended up being the exact same amount between the groups. And so what we did is we were able to program it. So if a house staff member tried to enter a non-study order of dextropropofol, I would be paged, or Matt would be paged. So we would call the unit, talk to the resident, the fellow, to the nurse, and just figure out why do they need to use this. And sometimes they didn't even realize they were on a study. I mean, crazy things. And we never had a case where patients got non-study drug. And so those are probably the biggest things with managing a study. There's all those, the education, IDS, IRB, and contracting, and just staying on top of things and realizing that you have the nurses. And we would, bring in pizza. We would buy Dunkin' Donuts, coffee cards for the nurses. And so we had a pocket full of those. So we wouldn't give them out to every nurse that ever did anything, but we were pretty liberal in giving like a $5 card if nurses completed all the paperwork. And they're so appreciative. It doesn't take much to get a nurse on your side. And, you're just very, very thankful. And, we had a couple of times where, physicians attendings would call me and just say, I absolutely have to know what the patient's on. So I run to the ICU, and so we talk about it, and I explain about how unblinding really destroys the study. So I'm like, what do you need to do here? So sometimes I agree with him or her that maybe we need to take them off study drug temporarily, but don't unblind them and get them back on study drug when something's passed. You know, the worst thing you do is stop a study, unblind it, and then you've lost your study patient.
And it sounds like from a planning perspective and just being involvement, three of the biggest pillars are communication, collaboration, and education. And it feels like that not only leads to research success, but just success as a member of the multidisciplinary team, right? As you're embedded, keeping those three things.
Absolutely. And, you know, often I, either Matt and I would try to attend rounds. Like we might not be the clinical pharmacist rounding on that patient, but we'd certainly be talking with the, you know, we obviously had ICU pharmacists rounding regularly. And so we'd talk to the pharmacist that morning and just make sure they're aware of the study. They would give us stuff. And we're like, just give us a page when they're going to be rounding on the patient. So we run up to the unit and be there on rounds. We would just stand back. And sometimes we wouldn't say anything or we'd just thank people. Other times everybody would turn to us like, this is a big issue. What are we going to do? And so then you have to do that. And then there was a couple instances where we weren't really sure what to do. So we were really lucky that Chris Hughes and Pratik Panarpandi, we had their cell numbers and pagers. And there was a couple instances we just weren't sure what to do. These were outside of protocol things. So we would just page them. They were highly responsive and they would give us guidance because we would say, well, we talked to the people at Vandy and this is what they recommended to do. So that was usually good enough.
This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. So let's kind of get into our trial of the week, kind of dive in and talk about what this study ultimately found. So I'll, for first-time trial of the week listeners, I'll kind of go into the methods, some of the study design. John will then come in, re-highlight something that I said, talk about anything I may have missed, and then talk about what his research, you know, him and his research team ultimately found. So dexmedetomidine or propofol for sedation in mechanically ventilated adults with sepsis, published in April 2021 in the New England Journal of Medicine. So U.S. multicenter double-blind RCT, 13 hospitals, so enrolled adult mechanically ventilated patients in a medical or surgical ICU requiring sedation with a suspected or known infection, i.e. sepsis, right? And they were enrolled between May 2013 and December 2018. So a couple key exclusion criteria, longer than 96 hours of mechanical ventilation prior to enrollment, planned paralysis for more than 48 hours, active seizures, bradycardia, current or history of heart block, obviously looking at those adverse effects. And then patients were randomized one-to-one to receive sedation with either dexmedetomidine or propofol, titrated by the bedside nurse to achieve the RAS goal. And like John was mentioning, it was a blinded study. So there was a titration chart. We had guidance in the protocol for managing over and under sedation and even temporary hold parameters. Primary endpoint, delirium and coma-free days at day 14 with an intent to treat assessment. And then those RAS and delirium assessments completed twice daily by trained researchers. So a couple key safety endpoints included, right? Hypotension, arrhythmias, acidosis, hypertriglyceridemia, and adrenal insufficiency. Now, due to a little slower than expected enrollment, that sample size target was lowered to 420 patients, but still provided greater than or equal to 80% power for those measured outcomes. So, John, come in and highlight any methodology I may have missed, something you want to emphasize, and then discuss what you all ultimately found.
Yeah, I think, for the primary outcome, we created a model as well. So we adjusted. So we basically found no difference in days alive without delirium or coma, but we created a multivariable model that accounted for other factors that could affect this. And so despite creating that model, we still found no difference. So, it's really important, obviously everybody realizes this studies like this to publish your statistical plan. Obviously everything's put in clinicaltrials.gov at the beginning. It's updated, has a timestamp on. I think it's really important. This is a really quick aside. It's really important no matter how small your study is. If you're doing a prospective study, it's really important to get that in clinicaltrials.gov. That's kind of expected to get it published. And you got to really think about things. You can realize after your second patient, like, oh, geez, this isn't going to work. We need to really change our protocol. You put a protocol or revision, but make sure you update clinicaltrials.gov. Because people, reviewers, like, I'll do this. If I'm reviewing a big study, I'll look at what the study how the protocol evolved in clinicaltrials.gov. And then you need to make sure you have your statistical plan. Generally, all this should be published ahead of time as well, or easily accessed. So people just want everything up front, because it's funny how you're not showing a difference and you're like, well, let's just add this correction or just do this other analysis. And you run it, that creates a whole host of problems. So everything was really well thought out. We use complex models to adjust for things, and we still found no difference in the primary outcome. And so I think it's important to, you know, a study should always be foundational for the primary outcome. I mean, it's your primary outcome, and that's what you're powered for. So I think that's an important thing. But we looked at a number of other things. And so when you look at the ICU outcomes, with, you know, time to mechanical ventilation, day spent without mechanical ventilation, ICU stay, hospital stay, there was virtually no difference. And surprisingly enough, there was no difference in some of the safety related things we would expect. And I thought we would get more bradycardia and more, you know, with dex, but it just shows that, you know, propofol causes bradycardia. And so heart rates, blood pressures, there was really little difference, vasopressor use. Serious adverse events were similar. So this is very, very important. And this actually takes a lot of time, because a lot of bad things happen in the ICU to patients. And you need to, especially if something happens to a patient and you come in the next morning and they've died. And so you need to start out as a principal investigator. And I would certainly use our, you know, I had obviously physician colleagues that were co-investigators. And so we would discuss the, you know, what we thought would happen, because you have to report this pretty quickly to your IRB and then to the to Vanderbilt. And so that's very, very important to really think about, was this expected or unexpected? Sometimes people are just getting sicker and sicker, vasopressors or multi-organ failure, and everybody that day expected the patient to die overnight. But then there's other patients, as we all know in the ICU, that they're doing okay, and then some acute event happens. Do they have a PE, or who knows, right? They have a cardiac arrest. So those ones would take longer to sort out, but you have to figure out what's the level of association with being enrolled in the study, what was anticipated versus unanticipated. So the safety reporting and how it's done is incredibly important. And that actually takes quite a bit of work to stay on top of this. And of course, we got some good guidance from sometimes our IRB, but also from Pratik and Chris Hughes. And then I think, So safety is a big issue. And then what's very novel about this study is the rigor by which we evaluated post-ICU outcomes. So we really built strong relationships with the patients and their families, not inappropriately, but they knew we were the investigative team. We'd make sure we had all their email information, their name. We would talk to the family. The other important thing is if LARs give consent for a patient, you have to reconsent that patient if they don't have delirium. And so we would have multiple attempts while the patient was on the floor before they went home or somewhere else to reconsent the patient. And so that follow-up is very, very important. And we didn't do the follow-up, it was Vanderbilt. They have trained psychologists and research coordinators that are doing this panel of, you know, psychologic and cognitive assessments and functional assessments. There's all kinds of things they did. The 3 and 6 months. And what's interesting is there was virtually no difference in any of these. Now, there certainly is a connection between days of coma and delirium with some of these outcomes, but other ones, not really. Certainly, there's a good connection between duration of delirium and 3 and 6 month cognitive function. We certainly know that. That's why it's so important to focus on recognizing and reducing delirium as quickly as possible in the ICU, because we know if we shorten the duration of delirium and reduce it, we're going to improve patients' long-term cognitive outcome. For a lot of the other psychological symptoms like PTSD and depression, anxiety, et cetera, the link has been well studied, but there's a very, very weak, poor association. So we actually had I'd have to look at the paper, but it was very, very high. We had about almost 85-90% of our patients participate in the long-term outcome. And that was just as a testament to, sometimes Vanderbilt will let us know we can't get a hold of the patient. So I would send an email, I'd call them and explain them, Dr. Devlin, you know, you were in the study and how important it is. If Vanderbilt calls, please, you know, answer the phone. This is their number. If you want to call Vanderbilt to set up an appointment, call this number. Because sometimes people just won't pick up their phone if it's an outside number, you know, or they don't recognize the number. And so that was very, very important, that long-term follow-up. And so there was a lot of complexities to study. That's why these studies are, million dollar studies, because there's so many people doing different things with the study. But again, no matter how we slice this, we didn't find a difference in these long-term outcomes, which was a little bit surprising. But it is what it is. Overall, I was a little bit surprised by the study. There's patients that I thought for sure were on dexmedetomidine, and it turns out they were on propofol and vice versa. So it just shows that how important blinding is.
Yeah, and over 90% of those eligible patients got evaluated at 6 months. So really, really good follow-up. And that's obviously the long-term outcomes and follow-up is one of the key methodologic differences between some of those earlier studies. But were there any other big differences in how you all designed or executed your study compared to some of those earlier ones that you had mentioned, like the first men's SEDCOM, Prodex, Midex, those sort of things?
Yeah, I would say that the two big things is, as I kind of alluded to before, we really made sure that we were using best practices in all patients. So this is really the A to F bundle. We really made sure we were making sure patients were undergoing either protocolization or daily awakening, and we were maintaining light sedation in these patients. There were periods it was deep sedation, but we were pretty aggressive. The nurse had to, we had to define a sedation goal, usually be a RASS of, minus one, minus two. So kind of light sedation, definitely not minus three, minus four. And then, the nurse had to document why that RASS was outside of that. We know nurses do an amazing job with their assessments and documenting RASS, but I think we could all know there's situations where nurses will put a RASS of, say, minus one, and the patient's actually minus three. Nurses, there's challenges with nurses maintaining patients at light sedation, and sometimes, or they don't detect that the patient's getting deeper, more deeply sedated. So that's why we did twice daily research staff. So Matt and I would come in and do our own RASS scores. And so that we could certainly talk to the nurse, well, you're documenting, you're getting a minus one, but we're getting a minus three. And then, so we would be sort of intervening there to reduce the thing. And we had to, the nurses had to collect every time they titrated the study drug or gave extra fentanyl or whatever, up and down, or even held it, they had to put a reason why and a timestamp. So we have all this data about basically what was going on in the nurse's mind in terms of titrating it to light sedation. And then we carefully collected data with compliance to the ADF bundle, including mobility. So that was very, very, very important. And we found the, we had put a lot of effort before the study in implementing the ADF bundle in our ICUs at Tufts Medical Center, and we were quite compliant with it. There's always situations where, the patient can't be mobilized, light sedation is not possible, but as long as you document the reasons for that, then that's sort of acceptable. Where it's not acceptable is you just are doing it and there's no goals and you're not trying to follow standard of practice.
So you mentioned kind of their RASS goal, and one of the things that kind of stood out to me when you look at table one in the text, the baseline characteristics of the patient, around 35 to 40% of patients were in a coma, meaning RASS negative four, negative five, closest to the time of randomization. So was there any working theory as to why that was?
Well, I think we as soon as patients got into the unit, we enrolled our patients very quickly. So I think that's part of it, was the earliness and the deeper sedation. Obviously, coma in some of these patients in their first 24 hours. It's actually a big issue. It's something we need to go all the way back to the, let's say it's the ED, even that's probably where most patients come from, is changing sedative practices in the ED. And, certainly I'm at Brigham and Women's Hospital now, and certainly, I think we're doing a much better job of thinking about depth of sedation in the ED and what patients really need to be safely managed, rather than just say we're going to deeply sedate them, wait till they settle out after a day in the MICU or the SICU. But I think we're thinking a lot more about what we do in the ED and the ICU and try to avoid that deep sedation, because Yash Chahabi himself has really published some seminal papers showing that first 48 hours of deep sedation, it's a big independent risk factor for mortality. So I think This whole let's just deeply sedate and let the dust settle till they're a little better, and then we'll worry about waking them up. I don't think that's the that should be the standard of practice moving forward. But I think that was still happening a lot in the study.
Yeah, median time from meeting inclusion criteria to initiation, about 22 hours, with the interquartile range only going to 31 and 33. So all enrolled less than 36 hours. So you were right, very trying to be quick on enrollment. So that does
Yeah,
make
and that's
sense.
important because that would be a huge bias, right? If the study intervention is really delayed, and that's some of the delirium studies, like with haloperidol, some of them are quite late, and by the time you get consent and do it, and that's a big bias in any study if there's a big delay in your intervention.
So you kind of alluded to this when we were talking about some of those earlier trials, that the SPICE 3, the secondary analysis published in the Blue Journal in 2023, found greater mortality in younger patients, right? They defined as less than 65 who received dexmedetomidine. So did you all find similar findings with the MENS 2 patients?
Yeah, we actually found a trend for that. So a little bit, so people getting dex had a had that were younger had a trend for more mortality. The curve, it's in the supplementary tables in the New England Journal paper. It didn't reach statistical significance, but there's a little bit of a trend. So we're actually working on a secondary analysis to sort of tease that out and correct for some of the other variables besides age that could account for changing mortality. Obviously, the obvious things are baseline severity of illness, but there's lots of other things that we know are associated with mortality. I think the SPICE 3 study, in particular, that important Blue Journal paper, it's a very well done analysis, but there's a few gaps in it. And I think, what it was is they only took people that either got Dex alone or propofol alone. So that's actually a small percentage of the population of the patients. There's a lot of patients that got both, whereas we have a cleaner cohort for that. They also did, they used a double stratification resampling analysis, and they based on to account for the dexmedetomidine dose and the varied propofol dose. But this is not controlled with changes in dosing over time. So they looked at one dose in their model. You really need to do sort of a time variant analysis of looking at this change. It becomes more complex, but you need to, you I think if you're really looking at whether the use of an agent affects a longer term outcome like mortality, you really need to account for what the dose relationship is with that outcome. And they actually didn't totally do that in their model. So that's another big thing. It's interesting, the European Union, I was at the ESICM Congress in Milan last year giving some talks. And, some of the countries in Europe have actually, have warnings now in their package insert about giving dex to, these younger patients. And I think we just need a lot more analysis into looking at this. And I don't think this, Yaya is a very, very talented scientist, and I think the SPICE 3 data is very, very compelling. But I'm not sure we're at the point where it should be driving policy.
So when potential safety, because like you mentioned, the unblinding and part of the clinical team calling you all as the research team. So explain to us why it's so important having like a temporary hold of the trial drug compared to permanent discontinuation or unblinding. Because the temporary hold, it happened in just under 30% of patients. So this is clearly something that is a fairly routine thing that comes up. Why is that such an important thing from a research perspective?
Yeah, I think so. What you want to build, if you know there's going to be potential safety issues or drug-related things that can happen. Let's just pick bradycardia, right? But there could be a lot of causes of bradycardia, right? So this can happen, and the culprit might not necessarily be the study drug. It might not be the propofol or dex. And it's important to sort that out before you unblind the patient and pull them out of the study. So in the MENS 2 study with bradycardia, if they had bradycardia, we would reduce the study drug, or we could hold it. And then we'd look for other causes in the next 24 hours for other causes for bradycardia. And if the bradycardia didn't resolve, and particularly if, you know, we're giving atropine and there's and it's really getting low, then that would be situations where we would restart the study drug. But lots of times, you know, study drug was held and the bradycardia dissipated. And sometimes you never really know why bradycardia dissipated. You know, sometimes there's reasons, sometimes you're not sure. The patients are more complex than I think we all realize. And so then we would just continue on with the study. We were watching it though. And generally where physicians are fine with, you know, the ICU team's fine with doing this once, but then if you restart the study drug and then the heart rate goes down again, like into the 50s, and people are getting concerned and they should be, that's where we would stop the drug. So most clinicians are willing, realizing there could be lots of causes. Most of the ICU team is quite willing to let you do this once, but they won't let you keep doing it. And that's where we pull them out. But that was a very small number of the patients. And if we pulled the patient out of the study, everybody would want to know, well, what was the patient getting? And so that's the other thing. Even if the patient's out of the study, there's the bedside nurse would still know, but we wouldn't tell the team. And it drove people crazy. Like house staff will. They will sometimes they're a little bored at night and it's a little bit of a game and they're like, what's the patient gave? And come on, Devlin, just tell us. I'm like, I don't know. And they would try to get the nurses, but see, we incentivized the nurses not to tell them. And they really kept it close to their chest and they wouldn't tell them. That's where we'd be pumping out the coffee cards. And so very little of this spread out. You know, so credit to the nurses and really to the team. They took this very, very seriously.
So, in that kind of same realm, how cool is it seeing your name on a New England Journal of Medicine, like especially a research article like this? What was that like? Describe to us. That had to be pretty surreal. Even somebody who is as published in different journals as you are, this is probably a pretty cool moment.
Yeah, it was really huge. You know, I did, obviously you can analyze how important your study is, and we, you know, with the SPICE 3 having been published a year and a half before, you know, I was like, oh, why would they publish a second study? But I guess we sold them enough on the science and the difference and how there was a lot of unresolved questions from SPICE 3, so that allowed that. So yeah, it's a cool, it's nice. You know, whether it's the new, it's such a, you know, it's really, really tough. You know, I think, you know, there's been at least with COVID, and we published this after COVID started. We finished the study, you know, it took a couple of years to do all clean up the database and analysis and write the paper. I think it sort of helped us that, you know, sedation and mechanical ventilation and everything was in 2000, 2001 when editorial decisions were made in New England. They're like, wow, this is a big issue. We have all these people in ICUs in COVID. That might have helped. You never really know, right? It's a sort of a panel of people. Obviously, Pratik and Chris Hughes are very, Wesley, they're very, very experienced at working with these top journals. So they did a great job of, you know, selling it, being responsive, and all the things that are needed to put it in. But I think, you know, everybody knows. I have a study I'm involved with right now, and it was a huge multicenter study. We all thought it was very, very important, but the New England Journal turned it down. So then you go to JAMA. And so you never know. It's a little bit of a turkey shoot.
So, you know, the other thing that I always think it's fascinating, the blinding process. So I'm guessing trying to keep away inquisitive minds, coffee cards on the East Coast are probably like gold essentially everywhere else, right? So what was the most challenging process of blinding dexmedetomidine and propofol? Understanding, right, that propofol is literally a milky substance. It's going to be like the moment you make eye contact with it, that the blinding is done.
It's really just really getting your nurses excited about this and how important the blinding is. But you know, it can be tricky. You know, patients are being mobilized and they're moving, and suddenly what you thought was tight right up to the, you know, they're most of these patients were sick enough that they had central lines, and so they're, you know, you never know. It just takes one little pull. So I'm sure there was, you know, obviously some of these patients were undergoing line changes and different things. I'm sure there's house staff that did see it, but we carefully incentivized them to just keep it to themselves. So.
kind of a perfect transition into our trial fun facts, because if you want a visual as to this blinding process, page 7 in the supplementary appendix has visual pictures of the whole process, which I think is so cool. So you can kind of see exactly what they did. Other ones, I want a movement for all protocols to include quotes. There's some great quotes in the materials here. Septic shock is the rude unhinging of the machinery of life. It's from 1862. I feel like that certainly still applies now. Multiple pharmacist investigators in the group that you definitely shout out. Matt Dupre, definitely friend of the pod, came on for another Trial of the Week episode. And I love the men's two logos. So quick aside, who designs these when studies have a study logo? Who does that?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I don't know. I've been involved with other studies, and we've kind of had investigators meeting and thought about the acronym right while we're writing the protocol. In terms of the logo, I'm not sure. Maybe there are people at Vanderbilt that do this for a living. They do so much research. But it's clever. All these things, the marketing, and it just shows that it's a much more, I don't know if the word professional is, but you know what I mean? It just goes all the way across. It's sort of a branding thing because the men's logo is on all of this bedside documentation. It's everywhere, right? And so people just see it and they're like, oh, that's men's too. So it's effective. It's important.
And what we learned from the 2024 critical care trials March Madness bracket, if your trial doesn't have an acronym, it is at a significant disadvantage of being known by the public. So having a good acronym certainly helps the awareness of it, just like you were kind of saying.
Absolutely.
So where are we now? The study was published April 2021. It's now the end of April, early May of 2024. So how do you apply the men's two findings in your practice now? Is there a specific takeaway or insight that you use routinely from this research?
I think this allows people, I think it's, as I kind of alluded to before, it's very, very important to, with each patient each day that's mechanically ventilated, to figure out, do they need continuous sedation? What's the goals here? What are we trying to do? And if people decide that the patient does need continuous sedation and not maybe just some intermittent fentanyl or even just some PRN low dose versus that, if they have, a period of agitation in a 24-hour period rather than starting a drip. So assuming these patients need continuous sedation, I think it allows a lot of the perceptions that people had is that, well, I need to use propofol when they're sicker and dexmedetomidine maybe when they're, when we're liberating them from mechanical ventilation. I think that gives permission and support to people, to clinicians, to early on to change things around a little bit and to decide each day what they want to give, because it probably doesn't make a difference for some of the outcomes that they think. But I still think, in this day and age where, dexmedetomidine is a little bit lower acquisition costs, I still think we have a big issue with wakefulness and mobility, which is so important. And dexmedetomidine has some analgesic properties, so you're probably going to use less opioids. So I'm also, when I'm rounding in the Brigham and, working, I'm also really focused on how many opioids patients are getting. And can we use multimodal analgesia if the patient has pain? Because the opioids aren't really a particularly great sedative. They don't really work that well for ventilator asynchrony. And so there's a lot of times you're using opioids as sedatives, like anal sedation, and probably we're not getting the goals with that opioid therapy, we think. So maybe, it all comes down to sort of respiratory drive, and people are like, well, Dex doesn't really work that well in respiratory drive, but maybe it's the ventilator adjustments we're making and it's not the agents. So I think it sort of gives permission for people like that. So I think Dex, we've certainly seen a much greater increase in Dex use earlier in patients because of the study. And I think that's fine. I think the study helped validate that practice, and it really allows more mobility, wakefulness. Maybe it's helping sleep a little bit more than propofol. I mean, we don't really measure sleep, but I think all of these things come, and I think it allows people to do, awakening and spontaneous breathing trials earlier, maybe even more frequently. And I'm sure it helps with liberation from mechanical ventilation faster. Propofol just it's a tricky drug to use, and I think you can get away with more things with dex. But then realizing there's patients that just, they're agitated, you can't figure out the other causes. They obviously need continuous sedation, and there's just a lot of patient heterogeneity in response. So you can be suddenly up to 1.5 with dex, the heart rate's barely budged, and I think it's important to recognize that this patient isn't going to really respond to dex if they're at that dose and you haven't seen a decrease in their sympathetic drive.
So you've been involved with both delirium-based research and kind of PADIS or sedative-based research like this trial. So what's more challenging to complete from like a trialist or kind of clinical research perspective, or is there any difference between those?
Well, I think they're I think it's hard to compartmentalize them completely. I think they're sort of interlinked. I think, there's increasing data that deep sedation is probably a risk factor for delirium. So like RASS score is a -3. But it's hard to completely tease that out with our current the CAM with our using CAM-ICU and RASS. So these are CAM-ICU is a great bedside screen. It's sort of the best we have. We use the ICDSC at Tufts because I helped develop it, but it, either one of them, but we know there's an effect on these delirium screening tools as patients get more sedated, particularly with CAM-ICU. And so it's hard to know. In someone's -3, it's really hard to do a good solid CAM-ICU, and obviously you can't really do it if they're in coma. So I think the point I'm getting at is I think we're entering in an era, and there's certainly a lot of products that are going to be coming to market where we're using different methods of EEG related monitoring and brain monitoring, which are much, much more sophisticated to recognize delirium and much more than just the BIS monitor. So the complex algorithms where we're really looking at these patients in terms of what their level of sedation is, and whether you're seeing EEG patterns like Weddell waves and stuff that are consistent with delirium. And then also, companies are really looking at sleep as well, because some of these same EEG patterns can help characterize what's happening with sleep. So I think, I bet within 5 years we're going to have, these monitors on virtually all of our patients. And I think that's going to become, this continuous neural monitoring is going to drive a lot of what's happening at the bedside, and not these, to be honest, somewhat crude delirium and sedation assessment tools. I think you'll still have both. But for patients that are a little bit more deeply sedated, we're not really sure what's going on sometimes in the brain with these patients.
So I found it notable that when we talked about landmark trials, some of the first ones you mentioned were the pillars of the A to F liberation bundle. When we talked about differences in those landmark trials, you started off with the ABCDF bundle. So, with the ever-increasing use of that bundle, do you think that we'll actually be able to see a difference in important outcomes with just like looking at our individual like pharmacotherapy agents, or is the non-pharmacologic kind of principles just so much more important, and that's going to make the difference?
Yeah, it's hard to tease out because each of the ADEF bundles have drugs sort of included. And how you measure compliance with the bundle, like, I was involved in the ICU liberation effort that had, 78 hospitals. And to look at compliance, we looked at whether the patient was screened twice a day with the CAM-ICU. But there's a lot more with, say, the D component. It's really looking at risk reduction, and which can be both non-pharmacologic and can also be pharmacologic, getting rid of, reducing opioids, getting rid of benzos, and some of the other agents that could be potentiating. And then there's lots of other physiologic causes and things the patient might have that could be corrected. So it's really hard to tease out the non-pharmacologic versus pharmacologic, because one sort of leads to the other, and it's this sort of cycle of stuff. But I think there's no magic bullet. I mean, I guess dex is sort of the closest thing we have to something that's going to improve patients. But I still sort of feel, and I educate our ICU teams, that most of these neuroactive medications are a means to an end, I guess, for patient safety, but they're not really inherently, they're supportive care as we get the patients through these things, but they're not really providing any strong therapeutic benefit, right? I mean, a lot of times we're just using them as sedatives to sort things out. So, there's no magic drug at all that is going to help really improve outcomes or reduce delirium or do any of these things. We just haven't invented it yet. So it's all prudent use of these agents because they all have toxicities, and getting them stopped when they leave the ICU and or don't need them, it's so important.
So let's end with this. Do you have a favorite non-benzodiazepine strategy? Do you, with all the research and things you've been involved in, is do you prefer dexmedetomidine or propofol one agent, or is it one of the classic, well, it depends situations?
Yeah, I think it depends. I think it's important to be thinking about dexmedetomidine earlier in patients because we know some of the issues with accumulation with propofol and safety and sleep. But it's not like I would, if someone's really sick with ARDS and the team's put them on propofol, I'm not really going to jump up and down. I think the more important thing is to have the patient, as sort of I mentioned before, prove to the team that they really need that propofol infusion and stopping it and using more as needed boluses of things if you can't identify causes for agitation that's going to stop that. I think that's really the biggest thing, and just really trying to decrease the continuous use of sedatives, and that includes fentanyl. Because I think these drugs just get on an autopilot, and once you get them going, it's a challenge to really stop them. There's a lot of hesitation, and maybe for good reason, with the nurse and other bedside clinicians. So, I think that's really the way to go. And certainly, people turn to, some of the great research that's come out of Scandinavia and Copenhagen and Denmark with light sedation versus no sedation, but those studies didn't really quite answer the question that we're using, and they still use a lot of opioids and analgesics in the control group, and I'm just not sure opioids are the best drug as a control group. Certainly, we need to treat pain, but then why aren't we using multimodal drugs? So I'm not sure if that's the definitive study either to show that no sedation is safe. I think we need to design a study that is more pragmatic, and sometimes a randomized study is not. Sometimes. A well-done cluster randomized study where you're randomizing ICUs are better than an individual patient RCT when you're looking at practices and longitudinal practices. It really involved changes in practices of the ICU team. And I think that those some big advantages of that, which are, they're a little bit more pragmatic, right?
You're exactly right. Well, John, this was wow, what a treat. Anytime I've had the chance to get to hear you speak at a national conference or things, wow, is the information just flowing heavy. I always learn something. This was absolutely no exception. Thank you so much for coming on, sharing not only your expertise as from the MENS2 trial, but really kind of looking at conducting prospective research and principles in the critically ill. Greatly, greatly appreciate you. Thanks so much.
All right, my pleasure, Nick. Thanks for all your insightful questions. I really enjoyed our discussion.
Can't thank John enough for taking the time to join. Be sure to reach out to him on Twitter or X at DevlinFarmD. If you enjoyed this as much as I did, please let me know at PharmacyToDose on social media or PharmacyToDose@gmail.com. You want to send me an email. And this episode reference list with the articles and guidelines we discussed and more. It's on the website, pharmacytodose.com, as well as that podcast episode description right below the timestamps. But until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. complex specialty care that cares about your ROI. It's possible, because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The podcast provides general information only and does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials in the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.